This is Barbara Glickstein. Dr. Kathleen Pike is Executive Director and Scientific Co-Director of the Global Mental Health Program. She's Associate Director of the Health and Aging Policy Fellowship Program at the College of Physicians and Surgeons, and is also Supervising Psychologist in the Eating Disorders Program at New York SPI. Dr. Pike has extensive experience globally, has lived and traveled throughout the world around issues on global mental health. Today she joins me to speak to that issue, as well as things that are being addressed here in the United States with the Affordable Care Act and now our presidential candidates discussing their health care programs. Thank you for joining me on Health Cetera.
Thank you very much, Barbara. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, you know, some people have access to good mental health care, but for too many people, mental health care is really not within reach, either resource-wise, geographically, practitioner access. And there is a population of people living with mental health issues globally, and again, also here in our country, where they don't know where their medication will come from, how they can get back into employment or back into their education if they've taken a break from school. Many of these concerns have really increased since the global recession, and every one of us knows somebody who's been affected by or is currently experiencing a mental health condition themselves. So I know, Dr. Pike, you are very much into the global mental health pulse of things, where they are. Tell us where things really are, and are things getting, are we seeing a greater incidence of mental health issues, which I know is a very broad topic, but where do you feel that things are currently in the global world around mental health issues?
Barbara, I can answer that question on a number of levels. I'd say at the highest level, I'm really optimistic. In the years that I've been working as a mental health professional, I've seen enormous change in our capacity to understand mental illness, to understand what puts people at risk for developing mental health problems, and for treatments that work. And we're seeing that the stigma is declining. It's still there. There's still many ways in which people feel that mental health conditions, mental health concerns are somehow different from other health concerns, but it is changing, and increasingly there's a voice and a dialogue that's occurring here in the U.S. and around the globe. We, in the course of the last decade, we've reached a tipping point, really, where the World Health Organization has become all the more effective and vocal about communicating how and why we need to think about mental health as an integrated piece of the global health agenda. And here within the U.S., the mental health concerns and mental health parity, for example, are conversations that that many, many people are having. And it's a historical moment. I mean, it's really a moment in history that we have a presidential candidate who has laid out a mental health policy, a mental health proposal. And this isn't just a few notes that Hillary Clinton scratched on the back of a napkin. She has really put forward a proposal that is thoughtful, that's informed, that is expansive, it's ambitious, but it's on the money. It's really hitting home on the most critical concerns that we have domestically and globally when it comes to mental health.
We'll get to Secretary of State, the presidential candidate, mental health initiative and plan in just a moment. But I wanted to stay global, and I follow your weekly blog, which is very informative. And a couple of weeks ago, you pointed out and welcomed and congratulated our former mayor, Michael Bloomberg's appointment as the global ambassador for non-communicable diseases for the World Health Organization. And you state in that blog, It's a personal letter to both congratulate and point out how important mental and behavioral health, just behavioral disorders are, that you stated they cause, that mental and behavioral disorders cause more health burden than any other non-communicable diseases. And of course, in terms of the personal needs of providing care, which you speak to, you address it as an economic situation as well. And the burden of mental and behavioral disorders is really greater than, you state, the four other major categories of non-communicable diseases, such as cancer, chronic respiratory disease, diabetes, and cardiovascular illness. I'm not sure most of us knew that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things about mental health conditions is that people live with mental health problems for decades if they go untreated. And so the burden on an individual, on the individual's immediate family, and on the larger society is enormous. And other health conditions present a different kind of burden and might bring a be associated with, you know, higher mortality rates. Mm. But for mental health, the issue is that people live for many, many, many years in a condition that where they are highly compromised in terms of their capacity to contribute to society. So when we think about someone, for example, who has a disorder like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or major depression, if it's left untreated, they could live for decades and not be able to work, not be able to contribute to the sustainability and the sustenance of their families. Whereas if the disorders are treated, they actually can become contributing members of society in a way that is transformative. And so the research that's been done on burden of disease has really brought that to the forefront now that we understand that burden of an illness isn't only the loss of life, but it's also living in a severely compromised state. And then additionally, I should say, we also know from the global burden of disease studies that have been conducted by the Institute for Health Metrics Evaluation that people with serious mental illness also have a much shorter life expectancy. In part, that's because if they have a significant mental health condition, frequently they're taken less seriously or their other health conditions are not attended to by the larger healthcare system. And so they're more likely to have other health conditions that go untreated and wind up being associated with earlier dying at a younger age. Another reason that there's a shorter life expectancy is that the vast majority of individuals who commit suicide have mental health conditions. And so,
often undiagnosed and untreated.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in certain segments of our population among young people, for example, adolescents and young adults, that is by some studies right now, is the second leading cause of death for adolescents and young adults. And so if we're losing 16, 18, 20-year-olds to suicide, the burden of mental illness, and these are individuals who potentially have an untreated depression, a first episode of mania, an emerging mental health condition that's not identified or treated in a timely way or in an effective way, you know, we're losing a lot of potential.
Yeah, you're speaking both globally and also I know here in the States and in the United States, these issues, and of course, every one of these points that you've raised demands a deeper dive, and we have made a commitment in our conversation prior to coming on the air to really talk about both the global perspective and then moving into, as I asked you, to prepare to talk to the current mental health programming here in the U.S., although everything that you're saying is translatable to us locally.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
The, you know, you've written that it takes political will and global collaboration and strategic solutions to address treatment and the social needs of people living with a mental health issue. And we know that with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, it did accomplish a couple of things. One, it expanded coverage, including mental health inpatient and outpatient, which itself encompasses substance use and abuse treatment. It reduced the impact of pre-existing conditions, so people with a history of mental illness cannot be discriminated against. And finally, and you mentioned this before, it expanded parity, and insurers must cover mental health on the same basis that they cover other health problems, although we do know that many mental health advocates are citing gaps that are so far making enforcing parity rules by insurance companies difficult, and that's an ongoing need to continue to address and enforce this issue of parity. Let's now go to presidential candidate Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's plan, which is called the Hillary Clinton's Comprehensive Agenda on Mental Health. It was just released about a week or so ago, maybe 10 days ago. It aims to improve care for 40 million Americans who have mental health issues. And it's also calling for a White House conference on mental health in her first year in office. It's quite a bold attempt, in addition to destigmatize mental health, because the plan puts treatment of mental health on par with physical health. So my first question is, could this plan be hampered, at least initially, by a severe shortage of mental health professionals at all levels, and more specifically, the shortage of providers who are willing to accept relatively low fees many insurers and government health plans pay?
Yeah. That's a key issue that we need to address within the health system broadly, and especially within mental health. And you're absolutely right that the proposal put forward by Hillary Clinton does attempt to address some of these issues and attempts to address it by supporting greater investment in training a larger mental health professional community. It also attempts to address the gaps by closing some loopholes in terms of mental health parity with other health conditions. And I think one of the other things for us to think about as a society and globally is that we want to think about all of these interventions as both treatment and prevention, because we know that if we treat individuals who have mental illness or significant mental health problems now, that we will reap significant benefits in terms of reducing risk related to mental health problems in their children. And that is partially biologically and partially environmentally, that good treatment today is prevention for tomorrow. And then in addition, we want to think societally about what are some of the ways to also address these mental health gaps by larger public health initiatives that will make a significant difference. And Mrs. Clinton also addresses some of those issues around social determinants of risk and understanding that issues like housing, issues like violence are related to mental health risk, and as a society, we also need to address those issues.
I hear your public health frame, which is mine as well, clear, loud and clear. I'm glad that this plan includes that. Let's go back to the idea of the workforce available and this more a different way of thinking about community health community health based and also professionally training people in to be available as mental health healthcare providers. You certainly have an expertise in this area. I'm familiar with your work on peer-to-peer training. So talk a little bit about that, where this plan also is calling for the use of peer support specialists. For example, like people who have recovered from substance use, how they are being can be called in and provided further training and certification to be peers for peer trainers. There are models that you are have been very effective using both here and globally in your work.
Right. You know, one of the things that has really changed in the time that I have been working in the field is an appreciation for what we call lived experience, for individuals who know firsthand what it's like to live with depression or live with bipolar disorder or crippling anxiety or substance abuse problem, and have made it to a place of recovery, meaning that they have move to a place where they're either managing their symptoms or really have resolved their symptoms in a healthy way and making the most of their lives. And those individuals have a wisdom and a training, so to speak, life training that is enormously valuable. And we have come to understand that and value it and respect it in a way that is a long time coming, actually. But as a community now, the recovery, what we call the recovery movement, individuals and caregivers, for that matter, have become much more effective in articulating how they can contribute to this, the needs of our society in improving mental health care. And we have very clear data, very well-done research documenting the extent to which such individuals can really contribute substantially to this workforce and contribute in very meaningful ways to providing effective care. So it's a really exciting and critical component of expanding our workforce as we think about how to meet the needs of individuals and families with mental health needs going forward.
One of the other growing areas in the is the use of telehealth services, and you also have written about the role of technology as an, being impactful. Certainly telehealth services, one of the plan one of the ideas in the plan calls for improving reimbursement of telehealth services. How impactful is that model, particularly in rural areas of the country and in parts of the country where we currently don't have access to the level of psychological and mental health services that are needed?
Right. You know, that's I think the potential is enormous. And I think we're learning a lot. And one of the things that's going to be very important as we aim to think creatively about new models for delivering services and meeting the mental health needs of various communities is that we need to either follow an evidence-based set of recommendations, meaning that we have good data to say that what we're doing has evidence to support our intervention. And when that evidence is not there, we need to be gathering evidence. We need to be gathering data to know, does this treatment work the way we think it will work? And with telemedicine, we're sort of halfway there. We have some data to say that, you know, a phone call, a Skype session, is just as effective as an in-person therapy session. And then there's the caveat. If, in fact, the person has had some personal contact with the healthcare provider, or the caveat might be depending on the mental health condition. So we need to know that there's tremendous potential in terms of telemedicine and that there are still questions about how to most effectively use the technologies today to deliver responsible care. And that's it's going to be a very dynamic set of questions and answers, because we have significant generational considerations. Babies born this year, as they have their own cell phones and their own laptops and their own other technologies that we don't even know what they'll be yet, their relationship to these technologies will be very, very, very different from what it means for an individual today with late life depression, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, someone today who's 80 years old and is managing an episode of depression, that individual will be much less familiar with certain technologies and much less comfortable on average than a 15-year-old. And so this is going to be a bit of a moving target in terms of thinking about what works, and we're going to have to really be thoughtful about what works for whom and at what stage of development. But the potential is enormous, and we need to be moving forward with we need to be gathering data about this. There are, for example, many, many, many apps on the phones today that are monitoring one's mood, or for eating disorders, or for anxiety and meditation. And there are some great apps that are out there. And there's some that look great, but we don't know whether they really work or not. And so we need to be scientific about this as much as we're excited about the new technologies.
We have just a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you in closing. So amid the speculation over Secretary Clinton's physical health and Donald Trump's mental health, what do you think of the ethics of the media diagnosing from afar, not just the media, but others who are coming forth and the media giving them airtime or print space? That's my first question. And finally, do you think that Americans are experiencing political distress during this political campaign?
So to take the first question, I find it telling and disturbing that people have made comments that along the lines of diagnosing our candidates and how, quote unquote, crazy they are, he or she might be, for one thing or another. Because to me, we have a tainted history of using terms, derogatory terms related to mental health conditions, like he's crazy, and I don't think it's helpful. So to the extent that the American people think that something one of the candidates does is troubling, they find something troubling, they find it distasteful, they find it unbelievable, they find it objectionable, that's perfectly okay with me, and I would encourage them to, all of us, to be well-informed and cast our votes for the candidate who we think is able to most constructively and ably lead this great nation. But I find the diagnosing from afar cavalier and not really helpful either to the candidates or to individuals who have real mental health conditions.
And finally, do you think Americans are experiencing political distress during this political campaign?
I think people are very distressed and feel that the stakes are very high and are really quite concerned. And when there's, you know, high stakes and high uncertainty, that's a time of distress. That's a likely time for individuals to feel distress, and that makes people vulnerable. Stress is a you know, as a risk factor to essentially activate other mental health concerns. So it is a stressful time for American society.
Dr. Kathleen Pike is Executive Director and Scientific Co-Director of the Global Mental Health Program. She's also the Associate Director of the Health and Aging Policy Fellowship Program at the College of Physicians and Surgeons. I want to thank Dr. Pike for joining me on HealthCetera today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me here.